We have established 8 distinct janitorial characters: Joe, Subas, Old Janitor, Raleigh, Konani, Eusebia, Rosa, and Yadwiga. Action figures are in the works. Sarah, Oprah, and Captain Hook, or How to Succeed by Sort of Looking Like Someone. I would never have made it into the cast of Saturday Night Live if I'd had to go about it in the regular way. When people audition for the show, they have to stand on the historic SNL home base stage and try to get a laugh from the 4 or 5 stone-cold strangers watching them. They have to demonstrate their funny characters and voices, of which I have none. My own child could tell you that my funny voices are completely derivative, and my Mr. Smee impression sounds nothing like the guy in the movie. I ended up on TV because Lorne Michaels likes to promote from within. When he had to choose who would replace David Letterman in Late Night on NBC, he picked unknown former SNL writer Conan O'Brien. When it was time to pick new anchors for Weekend Update in 1999, he did a nationwide talent search that went all the way across the hall. He let one of the head writers of the show, me, do a screen test with cast member Jimmy Fallon. By the time I tested for the show, I had already worked there for 3 years. I wasn't intimidated by anyone in the room, and I already had a day job at the show to fall back on. I didn't have to do characters, just read jokes without messing up. The timing of the Weekend Update turnover was, at that point in my life, the luckiest, craziest thing that had ever happened to me. In rehearsing for the screen test, I realized that I couldn't see the cue cards. I've worn glasses to see far away since I was 21, but I only need them for a few activities like going to the movies, finding Orion's belt, or reading cue cards. So I went to the doctor and got my first pair of contact lenses. The day of the screen test, I spent about 25 minutes nervously trying to get the lenses onto my eyeballs. Right up until camera time, I was sweaty and green from having to touch my own eyeball like that. If you've never had to do it, I'd say it's not quite as queasy-making as when you lose your tampon string, but equally queasish to a self-breast exam. If you are male, I would liken it to touching your own eyeball, and thank you for buying this audiobook. Jimmy and I did a screen test, as did a bunch of other people in the cast and several comics from the outside world. Because Jimmy was a star, and Lorne felt that I would make sure that the writing of the segment got done, Jimmy and I got the job. We did another camera test for set and lighting. Less than eager to touch my own eyeball again, I just wore my glasses the second time around. After the test, the great comedy writer and chronicler of human perversions, Tishon Shannon, came up to me and said in his Texas drawl, "You should leave them glasses on, sister." And so, a commonplace librarian fetish was embraced for profit. Once I was hired to do Update, every now and then the writers would put me in a sketch. This usually only happened if all the other women were already in the sketch and they had run out of bodies. But they didn't use me much because I could never really look like anybody else. Molly Shannon has a great face for wigs. Her features are delicate and symmetrical, and her coloring is neutral enough that she can play a blonde Courtney Love or a raven-haired Monica Lewinsky, and you buy it. Maya Rudolph's face can change from Donatella Versace to Beyoncé in 1 minute and 17 seconds. I've seen her do it. I always just look like me in a wig. Check your PDF for pictures of me not resembling Dina Loewen, Janice Dickinson, and Barbara Pierce Bush. The closest I ever came to looking like anyone else was when they tried to dress me up like a bearded lady from the circus and I looked just like my brother. It has something to do with the fact that my eyes and eyebrows are very dark, but my skin is very pale and my nose is kind of long. I was absolutely useless when it came to being a lookalike. So you can imagine my surprise. So, you can imagine my surprise on August 29th, 2008, when my husband called me into the room to watch CNN. John McCain had selected first-term Alaska Governor Sarah Palin as his running mate, and two things were obvious right away. One, this was a craven attempt to lure Hillary voters away from Obama, and two, "She kind of looks like you," my husband said. I scoffed. It was just that she had brown hair and glasses. But the emails started coming from friends and cousins and co-workers. People seemed to think we really looked alike. The most powerful minds in the world, cable news anchors and internet users, started speculating as to whether I would play her on Saturday Night Live. We had already done 2 full seasons of 30 Rock and were just beginning to shoot season 3, If I had been wondering whether people were aware of the new show, the answer was now clear: they were not. No one had even noticed that I didn't work at Saturday Night anymore. Also, no one seemed to remember that when I did work there, I only did the news. They didn't care. They were in a blind frenzy. Brown hair, glasses! Meanwhile, over at 30 Rock, Oprah Winfrey had expressed the slightest polite interest in being on the show. Desperate to find a larger audience, we jumped at this chance like meth heads over a cough syrup counter. Robert Carlock wrote a hilarious script where Liz Lemon meets Oprah on a plane. You can buy it on iTunes. We sent the script to some women at Harpo who told us that Oprah liked it and they were sure she would do it. We were ecstatic. As the summer wore on, however, it became clear that Oprah had not actually seen the script. In late August, Oprah's chief of staff, I'm not joking, called to say that Oprah was really sorry, but she would not be able to do the show. This was planned as our second episode of the season, and Oprah was irreplaceable in it. We had already shot half the episode. If this fell apart now, it would cost the show hundreds of thousands of dollars. I had the nerve-wracking task of getting on the phone with Ms. Winfrey and trying to talk her into it. I am terribly, terribly suited for such jobs. I'm shy. I have no salesmanship. I am actually able to convey sweaty palms over the phone. I didn't try to sell Ms. Winfrey on the comedy of the episode. Instead, I appealed to her knowledge of television schedules and how royally cornholed we'd be if she declined. She listened because she is smart and generous. She agreed to let us do a rewrite of the script and consider it, but I knew that until that Oprah footage was in the can, I would carry around a very specific form of physical anxiety that feels kind of like my heart shrinking up like a raisin. Meanwhile, across town, the staff of Saturday Night Live was preparing to start their season early on September 13th to cover this very important national election. The show is always exciting during election years and has proven its political relevance time and time again over its 35-year run. I have to include sentences like that because I'm trying to get college credit for this. On September 3rd, 2008, then-Governor Palin accepted the vice presidential nomination. Around this same time, Oprah formally agreed to be on 30 Rock, and it was determined that my daughter's third birthday party would have a Peter Pan theme. Each of these events was equally important in my life. Lorne and I discussed the overwhelming public opinion, hyperbole, that I should play Governor Palin. Apparently that morning, both Lorne's doorman and Robert De Niro had stopped him to say how uncanny the resemblance was. Did we dare disappoint Frank the doorman and Robert De Niro? Lorne and I shared the same hesitation. If everyone in the world has the same casting idea, it couldn't possibly be a good idea, right? When you work at SNL, people come up to you all the time and say stuff like, you know what you should do? A skit about my brother-in-law. Or, you should do a skit where Tiger Woods and Obama are gay for each other. Or, that show hasn't been good since the 70s. People always have a lot of opinions about the show, and they're never right. So why would they be right now? But Lorne is also an old-school producer, and somewhere, deep down, I think he knew that if he cast me in the part by popular demand, even if I sucked, it might be a good rating. A good rating is a good rating, even if people tune in just to be mad about how much it sucked. We decided not to decide. This is another technique I learned from Lorne. Sometimes if you have a difficult decision to make, just stall until the answer presents itself. Back at 30 Rock, we scheduled our shooting day with Miss Oprah Winfrey. She generously offered to fly in on Saturday, September 13th and pick up her scenes. This was perfect. I could safely plan my daughter's party for Sunday the 14th. The only remaining problem was that I could not find Peter Pan cups or plates. You can find Tinkerbell or Captain Hook, but no Peter Pan. Was Disney in some kind of legal conflict with the J.M. Barrie estate? There was no time to get involved in that. I had less than a week. Captain Hook cups mixed with Tinkerbell plates would have to suffice. It was 4 days until the season premiere of SNL, and still no decision from Lorne. I was walking around the 30 Rock offices telling everyone that I couldn't possibly play Palin. I was too busy, and I didn't do impressions, and it's important to say no sometimes, and I couldn't possibly commit to it. But in the back of my head, I was very aware that no one had actually asked me to do it. Has he called you yet? Has he called you yet? My friends were asking. Nope. I just slumped against my locker and twirled my ponytail. I had arrogantly thought that it was all about me and whether I felt like doing it, but of course, It was Lorne's decision to make and not mine. It's his show. Still trying to control the situation, I called Lorne's office on Wednesday evening after their read-through and left a message to say I didn't want to play Palin should it come up. My call was not returned. On Wednesday night, Alice and I drew a picture of Peter Pan to hang up at the party. I explained to her the apparent licensing problem with the plates. She was understanding and suggested we relax by pretending to be Wendy and a mermaid for the next 65 minutes. On Thursday, Oprah's office checked in to say that she had heard I might be doing Saturday Night Live that Saturday, and would I rather reschedule her shoot? No, no, no. Get the O in the can for the sake of my heart raisin. Thursday morning, I checked the status of my Amazon.com order. The birthday present I had ordered was not here yet. I also started peeking at YouTube clips of Sarah Palin. How hard could that voice be? On Thursday evening, Lorne called to say that Seth Meyers had written a piece, and I should come over late Friday evening and rehearse it with Amy, and if it didn't feel right, someone else would do it. I rambled through my concerns. Kristen Wiig would be better at it. Lorne agreed. I felt that whatever I appeared in, people would assume that I wrote it and that it was expressing my personal opinions. These were delusions of grandeur, of course. Remember, no one even noticed that I had quit. Regardless, I didn't want to be a stock character that any writer on the staff could make use of. I didn't want, for example, to play Sarah Palin in a sketch about how Hillary Clinton was a jealous dyke or something. Also, I was a little skittish to do political comedy after getting myself into trouble a few months before. Sidebar, my mouth goes into politics, the rest of me is forced to follow. After the Writers Guild of America strike that changed the world in 2008, I was asked to host the first Saturday Night Live back on the air. Finally, the world would see my full range of comedy characters, from grouchy librarian to Russian librarian. Seth and Amy asked if I wanted to come on Weekend Update to do a woman news segment. The piece the Update writers and I threw together was meant to be about the way Hillary Clinton was being treated and perceived during the campaign. It was meant to point out that America seemed more comfortable with a male minority candidate than a white female candidate. It was meant to discuss, in joke form, that people didn't take to Hillary because of this vague feeling that she was kind of a bitch and how unfair that was. It was meant to be about gender politics, not actual politics. What came out was an overt Hillary Clinton endorsement. It wasn't that I didn't like Mrs. Clinton as a candidate. It's just that Weekend Update features are written so hastily. If you're hosting, you don't even start writing them until Saturday afternoon. It's no surprise that they can come out sloppy and strident. I was in the host's dressing room between dress rehearsal and air, feeling like Stallone, but without the cigar or the nice teeth. I just wanted the show to be good. I needed a punchier ending to the Hillary Clinton update piece, and my friend and makeup artist Richard Dean suggested Bitch is the New Black. It made sense in the context of the piece and was certainly punchy. Also, it was about 11:10 p.m., so yeah, let's go with that. I would have chosen to stop short of being overtly political if I'd had more time to smooth it out. Because one, I think it's more powerful for comedians and news anchors to be impartial. And two, I'm a coward. The next day, Obama supporters on the Huffington Post were outraged. Former President Clinton called me at home to thank me. Mrs. Clinton called me later that same day to thank me, proving that Bill is just a tiny bit better at the flash charm handshake part of politics. When I told my mom that former President Clinton had told me I did a great thing for my country in defending Mrs. Clinton like that, she made a barfing sound. Did I mention that my parents are Republicans? Friday came, and I know what you're wondering. Yes, the Imaginext pirate ship and sea monster I had ordered did arrive, and I wrapped them in my dressing room between setups. I shot for 12 hours at the fake 30 Rock. Then, after inspecting the cleanliness of Oprah's airplane set and dressing room for the next morning, this is not something I would normally do, but I wanted everything to be perfect for Miss Oprah. John Hamm, if you come back, I will not be pre-inspecting your toilet. I may inspect it afterward to make sure you didn't steal anything. I headed over to the real 30 Rock at about 10 p.m. to rehearse with Amy Poehler. I took comfort knowing that Amy could carry the sketch if I stunk it up because she's such a skilled and generous performer. I mean, she's no Catan in a dress, but considering the Darwinian limitations on women in comedy, she does very well for herself. We went out on the studio floor in front of the crew, and I tentatively tried out my half-baked impression. Not the worst. Significant room for improvement. Because Seth and I had written for real impressionists like Daryl Hammond over the years, we knew there were certain tricks we could employ. Whatever sounds are helpful to the impression, you use as many of them as possible in the writing. For Palin, it was a lot of hard R's, words like reporters and commentators. Words you can't say, you avoid. For example, I've never been able to figure out how she says Todd. Amy added jokes, I added some jokes. The whole process was pleasant and collaborative and easy. Saturday, September 13th, I got up at 6 a.m. and filmed my scenes with Oprah at Silver Cup Studios in Queens. She was great. She really does smell nice. And I got to hug her a lot in the scenes. If you're not into iTunes, you can buy 30 Rock on DVD at your local Walmart. Between setups, I sat with my daughter on my lap and watched Governor Palin on YouTube and tried to improve my accent. Oprah seemed genuinely concerned for me. How much rehearsal time are you going to get? Do you have tapes of her to listen to? You're going there right after this? By the way, when Oprah Winfrey is suggesting that you have overextended yourself, you need to examine your fucking life. Around 5:30 p.m., Oprah and I wrapped, and I went over to SNL, but not before stealing an untouched edible arrangements bouquet from Oprah's dressing room to serve at the birthday party the next day. The rest of the night went thusly. I got to SNL, I tried on my wig and outfit. Amy and I did the sketch 3 times, run-through, dress rehearsal, and live. And that was it. By 11:40 p.m., I had the rest of the show to relax and have a glass of wine. It was actually the first night out my husband and I had in months. The whole experience was surprisingly serene. Maybe it was because the Oprah footage was in the can and my heart could stop eating itself. Maybe it was because I was safe at the side of my sweet friend Amy. Maybe it was because I knew I couldn't get fired because I didn't even work there anymore anyway. Obviously, a big part of it was that Seth had written a very good sketch. I was not nervous at all, and doing that sketch on live TV was a pure joy I had never before experienced as a performer. Here's a sketch.
And now, a nonpartisan message from Governor Sarah Palin and Senator Hillary Clinton.
Good evening, my fellow Americans. So excited when I was told Senator Clinton and I would be addressing you tonight.
And I was told I would be addressing you alone.
Now, I know it must be a little bit strange for all of you to see the two of us together, what with me being John McCain's running mate
and me being a fervent supporter of Senator Barack Obama. As evidenced by this button.
But tonight we are crossing party lines to address the now very ugly role that sexism is playing in the campaign.
An issue which I am frankly surprised to hear people suddenly care about.
You know, Hillary and I don't agree on everything.
Anything. I believe that diplomacy should be the cornerstone of any foreign policy.
And I can see Russia from my house.
I believe global warming is caused by man.
And I believe it's just God hugging us closer.
I don't agree with the Bush doctrine.
I don't know what that is.
But, Sarah, one thing we can agree on is that sexism can never be allowed to permeate an American election.
So please, stop photoshopping my head on sexy bikini pictures.
And stop saying I have cankles.
Don't refer to me as a MILF.
And don't refer to me as a flurge. I googled what it stands for and I do not like it.
Reporters and commentators, stop using words that diminish us like pretty, attractive, beautiful,
harpy, shrew, boner shrinker.
Politics may differ. My friend and I are both very tough ladies. You know, it reminds me of a joke we tell in Alaska.
Oh, boy.
What's the difference
lipstick
between a hockey mom
lipstick
and a pit bull?
Lipstick.
Lipstick.
There you go.
Just look at how far we've come. Hillary Clinton, who came so close to the White House, and me, Sarah Palin, who is even closer. Can you believe it, Hillary? I cannot. It's truly amazing, and I think women everywhere can agree that no matter your politics, it's time for a woman to make it to the White House.
No, mine! It's supposed to be mine. I'm sorry, I need to say something. I didn't want a woman to be president. I wanted to be president, and I just happen to be a woman. And I don't want to hear you compare your road to the White House to my road to the White House. I scratched and clawed through mud and barbed wire, and you just glided in on a dog sled wearing your pageant sash and your Tina Fey glasses.
Amazing time we live in. To think that just 2 years ago I was a small town mayor of Alaska's crystal meth capital. And now I am just one heartbeat away from being president of the United States. It just goes to show that anyone can be president.
Anyone. Anyone. Anyone.
All you have to do is want it.
Yeah. You know, Sarah, looking back, if I could change one thing, I probably should have wanted it more.
So, in the next 6 weeks, I invite the media to be vigilant for sexist behavior.
Although it is never sexist to question female politicians' credentials, please ask this one about dinosaurs. In conclusion, I invite the media to grow a pair. And if you can't, I will lend you mine.
And as we say in Alaska,
we say it everywhere.
Live from New York, it's Saturday night!
This sketch could easily have been a dumb catfight between two female candidates. What Seth and Amy wrote, however, were two women speaking out together against sexism in the campaign. In real life, these women experienced different sides of the same sexist coin. People who didn't like Hillary called her a ball buster. People who didn't like Sarah called her Caribou Barbie. People attempted to marginalize these women based on their gender. Amy's line, "Although it is never sexist to question female politicians' credentials," was basically the thesis statement for everything we did over the next 6 weeks. Not that anyone noticed. You all watched a sketch about feminism, and you didn't even realize it because of all of the jokes. It's like when Jessica Seinfeld puts spinach in kids' brownies. Suckers! That night's show was watched by 10 million people, so I guess the director at the Second City who said that the audience doesn't want to see a sketch with two women can go shit in his hat. The next day's birthday party was also successful, and I believe had an equal impact on the 2008 presidential campaign. Special thanks to my sister-in-law, Dee, who brought macaroni and cheese, and Jesse, who made jerk chicken. There is a now-historic photo in your PDF of my friend Michael's pirate ship cake. The next few weeks were very exciting. On Wednesday, my daughter started preschool. The Sunday after that, 30 Rock won 7 Emmys. Meanwhile, once a week, I went to my goof-around night job and did these sketches, and this is what I remember about them. Week 2, Katie Couric interviews Sarah Palin. There's a picture of this in your PDF, and I think Amy would want me to say that she is very pregnant in this photo. Seth had originally written a piece with Sarah Palin in one, which means by herself, talking straight to the camera. I asked if we could change it so that I could be with Amy again. Since my background is improvisation and not stand-up, I really prefer the buddy system on stage. The Katie Couric interview was basically a sketch handed to us on a plate. Seth quickly wrote a draft, and because I was watching Mrs. Palin over and over again on YouTube to try to improve the impression, I asked Seth if I could put in this long, rambling run about the bailout that was mostly just transcribed. By the second week, I realized what made this experience so fun and different. For the first time ever, I was performing in front of an audience that wanted to see me. I had spent so many years handing out flyers, begging people to check out my improv team. I was so used to trying to win the audience over or just get permission to be there that a willing audience was an incredible luxury. It was like having a weight lifted off you. I thought, this must be what it's like for Daryl when he plays Bill Clinton, or for Tracy Morgan when he does anything. People are just happy to see them. Week 3, the vice presidential debate. This was my favorite sketch, and there are 3 reasons why. 1, I felt like I contributed a lot of jokes to this one, so my writer ego likes it the best. 2, Queen Latifah was there. 3, I thought the speeches that Jim Downey wrote for Jason Sudeikis as Joe Biden were brilliant. Especially the stuff where Biden is trying to prove that he's not some Washington elite by talking about how he's from Scranton, Pennsylvania, the most godforsaken place on earth. I thought this was ingenious because not only was the ad hominem attack on Scranton a hilarious comedy left turn, it also exemplified what the election had become. Instead of talking about issues, everybody was just trying to prove how down home they were. "I'm just like you," was the subtext of every speech. Politics and prostitution have to be the only jobs where inexperience is considered a virtue. In what other profession would you brag about not knowing stuff? "I'm not one of those fancy Harvard heart surgeons. I'm just an unlicensed plumber with a dream, and I'd like to cut your chest open." The crowd cheers. 2 jokes I remember writing for the debate sketch are this one about global warming. Gwynne Ifill: "Senator Palin, address your position on global warming and whether you think it's man-made or not." Gwynne: "We don't know if this climate change whoozy what's it is man-made or if it's just a natural part of the end of days." And this one. Gwynne Ifill: "Governor Palin, would you extend same-sex rights to the entire country?" Governor Palin: "You know, I would be afraid of where that would lead. I believe marriage is meant to be a sacred institution between 2 unwilling teenagers." This joke about the sacred institution of marriage was probably the roughest joke we did. Rough in sketch comedy language means harsh or dark. As I'm sure you remember, Mrs. Palin's daughter Bristol was pregnant at the time and engaged to her high school boyfriend Levi Johnston. This joke was right on the edge of being too directly about the Palin family. I felt, however, that because Bristol's pregnancy and subsequent engagement had been embraced by so many as a shining example of the pro-life movement, that it was officially part of the campaign. Also, the joke wasn't that rough. An example of a truly rough joke would be this. A pedophile walks through the woods with a child. The child says, "These woods are scary." And the pedophile says, "Tell me about it. I have to walk back through here alone." That's a rough joke. Or Sarah Palin: "To think that just 2 years ago I was a small-town mayor of Alaska's crystal meth capital, and now I am just one weird mole away from being president of the United States." A John McCain skin cancer joke? Too rough. That was a joke I tried in dress rehearsal in the Sarah Hillary sketch. My friend Jen Rogers, who is a cancer survivor, thought it was funny. The audience did not. I remember very distinctly walking off stage after Latifah yelled live from New York, thinking that this was the most fun, exciting thing I would ever do. I remember thinking that this was a permanent win. No one would ever be able to take it away from me. The proof existed permanently on tape that on this one occasion, I was funny. Here at the midway point of my 6-week career, the sketches were really becoming a thing. They were being watched around the world on the internet. A French newspaper accidentally ran a picture of Amy and me from the Katie Couric sketch, thinking it was a real picture of Couric and Palin. Although I think that had less to do with the power of satire and more to do with the fact that, to the French, we are all indistinguishable fat dough balls. And oh, the cable news reportage! The great thing about cable news is that they have to have something to talk about 24 hours a day. Sometimes it's Anderson Cooper giggling with one of the Real Housewives of Atlanta. Sometimes it's Rick Sanchez screaming about corn syrup. They have endless time to fill, but viewers get kind of bummed out if they supply actual information about wars and stuff, so media portrayal of Sarah Palin and SNL and I became the Carrageenan in America's News Nuggets for several weeks. I was a cable news star, like a shark or a missing white child. The downside of being a cable news star is that any asshair with a clip-on tie can come on as an expert and talk about you. One day, by accident, I caught this tool, Tom something, on MSNBC saying that he thought I had not conducted myself well during all this. In his opinion, Mrs. Palin had conducted herself with dignity, and I had not. But, by the way, I'm pretty sure Tom's only claim to expertise is that he oversees a website where people guess incorrectly who might win showbiz awards. There was a patronizing attitude behind Tom's comments that I certainly don't think he would have applied to a male comedian. Chris Rock was touring at the time, and he was literally calling George W. Bush retarded in his act. I don't think Tom something would have expressed disappointment that Chris was not conducting himself sweetly. I learned how incredibly frustrating it is to watch someone talk smack about you and not be able to respond. This kind of anger, I suspect, is the main thing Mrs. Palin and I have in common. When someone says something bad about us, we want to respond. However, I, as an experienced member of the East Coast media elite, know that you can't even try. You can rage to your spouse all you want, but the moment you post internet comments under an assumed name or call in spontaneously to a radio show to assert that you are not a butterface, or write that letter to Lisa DeMoraes of the Washington Post instructing her to go suck a bag of dicks, you have crossed the border into crazy town, never to return. Around this time, my old friend Damian Holbrook, a writer for TV Guide, had arranged to interview me for the new fall season. Damian and I did summer showtime together. See if you can guess what I changed his name to in that chapter. I named the character Damian in Mean Girls after him. He spent the day on the 30 Rock set and came over to my apartment for dinner afterward. Damian has a great sense of humor, and we laughed a lot. After dinner, long after what I considered the interview portion of our day to be over, Damian asked me what I would do if McCain Palin won the election. Would I continue to moonlight at SNL? I said in a jokey, actressy voice, "If they win, I will leave Earth." It was clearly a joke about people who say stupid things like that. No matter what your political beliefs, everyone knows some loudmouth. If Bush wins, I'm moving to Canada. If Bush wins again, I am seriously moving to Canada. If Obama wins, I'm going to shoot that motherfucker, etc. But Damian put "I'm leaving Earth" in his article, and in print it looked sincerely idiotic. His editor leaked it in advance of the issue to generate attention for the magazine. Cable News took the bait and ran with it. I looked like a grade-A dummy. I was annoyed at Damian, but mostly I just found it disconcerting that I could get in trouble for a half-baked joke I made in my own home was a level of scrutiny I did not enjoy. My brother called me, genuinely concerned. I should watch what I was saying because there are a lot of nuts out there. I hung up the phone and burst into tears in the 30 Rock writer's room. Poor Matt Hubbard watched my meltdown with a look of concern and disgust, usually reserved for watching your mom vomit. Week 4. Weekend Update Primetime Special with Will Ferrell. SNL was doing half-hour specials on Thursday nights at 8:30. I was able to be in one in what can only be described as my trip to sketch comedy fantasy camp. I got to stand next to Will Ferrell as George W. Bush and Daryl Hammond as John McCain. These two dudes are the masters. Daryl is a precise technician who can do anyone from Jesse Jackson to Donald Trump to Al Gore. Will, on the other hand, is an impressionist in the style of the Impressionists. His technique is loose, bordering on random, but when you step back, he has rendered George W. Bush. If Daryl is Da Vinci, Will is Monet, and I am me in a wig. This sketch had a different tone than the other sketches because it was written by the world's number one comic genius, Adam McKay, Anchorman, Talladega Nights. It was about George W. Bush trying to endorse the McCain-Palin ticket and John McCain trying to avoid the endorsement. I think there's a picture of this in your PDF, too. By the way, it's a miracle that you cannot see my Spanx in that picture. It's worth pointing out that this sketch was the tipping point for my Republican parents. They had been as excited and entertained as anyone for the first few weeks. Maybe the tone of the sketch was more aggressive, or maybe the cable news cycle had worn them down into thinking we were being mean, but the end result was a scolding from my mom. It's getting to be too much now. Week 5, the sneaker upper. The sneaker upper is a term that veteran SNL writer Jim Downey coined to describe that queer moment when a famous person sneaks up behind the actor who plays them and pretends to be mad about it. I would expand Jim's definition to include any time someone being parodied volunteers to come on the show and pretend they're in on the joke. Comedy writers hate sneaker uppers. On a pure writing level, it's just lame. But like other lame things, sorbet, line dancing, New Year's Eve, people seem to love it. I'm not saying I'm above a sneaker upper. During my time at SNL, I was involved in at least 5 of these things. They varied in success and included people ranging from Debbie Matenopoulos to Monica Lewinsky. Also, by the way, I wanted to call the book The Sneaker Upper, and they thought it was too weird. If you were having a sneaker upper week, your coworkers would ask sympathetically, how's that going? What could you do? Some weeks you got to produce a pure little comedy piece that was dear to your heart and had a great host like Alec Baldwin or Julia Louis-Dreyfus in it. Some weeks you had to sit and take notes from the smallest Hansen brother about what jokes he didn't care for. The sneaker upper is just an occupational hazard, and as occupational hazards go, it's much better than getting your arm caught in the thresher. What I'm getting to is, during week 5, Sarah Palin's campaign people called Lorne to say she'd like to be on the show. I was against it. One, it was a classic sneaker upper, and we had been so successful on a writing level up to that point. Two, things were getting tense. McCain-Palin supporters were yelling racist invective at rallies, and the campaign wasn't exactly shutting that behavior down. I didn't want to joke around and hug her on camera and be perceived as endorsing their campaign. 3, I had seen footage of Governor Palin and her sweet littlest daughter Piper getting booed at a Flyers game. Classy hometown. Real classy. I was sure that the liberal New York City studio audience for SNL would boo the shit out of her. I didn't want that to happen, and I definitely didn't want to stand next to her while that happened and have it seem like we had laid a trap for her. I didn't want to be complicit in an ugly live TV moment during what was becoming an increasingly ugly campaign. Lorne didn't think it would be a problem. However, Lorne was also riding 3 weeks of 7-plus ratings, and the real Mrs. Palin would surely exceed that. She was ratings gold. Pure nuggets of ratings gold, just waiting to be extracted from the teeth of a corpse. In this metaphor, I'm not sure if the corpse represents my career, the McCain campaign, or broadcast television. I told Lorne that if the real governor did the show, I would sit this one out. Lorne suggested I not decide so quickly. He and I both knew that things had gotten so weird in the cable news cycle that if I didn't show up, it would be just as much of a fake news story. The CNN crawl would have read, "Mean girl, Faye refuses to appear with Palin. Palin supporters call the move un-American and vaguely Jewish. Tonight at 9, Rick Sanchez uncovers the corn syrup myth." It really was a catch-22 for me, unless Lorne would just decline to have her on. And that wasn't going to happen. As previously mentioned, ratings gold. I was hurt that Lorne would put me in this position. At the same time, it is never lost on me that he also put me in the position of being on TV in the first place, which no one else in the world would have done. Trust me, I used to audition for things. I called Lorne and said I would do the show, but that it was very important to me that we protect Governor Palin from being booed. I suggested that he start with her backstage in the 8H hallway. The live audience would only see her in the monitors, and not knowing if what they were seeing was live or pre-taped, they would be less likely to boo. My only other request was this. I never wanted to appear in a two-shot with Mrs. Palin. I mean, she really is taller and better looking than I am, and we would literally be wearing the same outfit. I'd already been made to stand next to Jennifer Aniston and Salma Hayek on camera in my life. A girl can only take so much. And honestly, I knew that if that picture existed, it would be what they show on the Emmys someday when I die. And I'd really rather they show this other picture that's in your PDF. That's awesome. Lorne called back the next day to say that he had an idea and Seth was working on a draft. We'd start with me in a fake press conference, then cut to Lorne and Governor Palin backstage. It was Lorne's idea to have Alec Baldwin there, too. As a beloved SNL host and a known liberal crusader, Alec standing next to Sarah would send out an everybody be cool message to the audience. We rehearsed on Saturday afternoon, as usual, but this time there was massive security in the building for the vice presidential nominee. I met Mrs. Palin on the studio floor when we came out to rehearse. She was in full hair and makeup because she'd come straight from a campaign stop. I had my hair in a ponytail and looked my trademark exhausted. We shook hands and I blurted out, "Don't worry, they'll put makeup on me." As we took our places to rehearse, my daughter pointed animatedly at Governor Palin on the monitor. "She's confused." Mrs. Palin laughed. We didn't hang out much, but we chatted a little about children. She offered her daughter Bristol to babysit Alice during the show if need be. I thanked her, saying Alice was too little to stay for the show. She always went home with her dad after the dinner break. I can't imagine Bristol would have been too psyched to do that anyway. It was her 18th birthday. She was in New York City, and I had made a vicious joke about her a week earlier. But, you know, I appreciated the momness of Mrs. Palin's offer. She might as well have said, "You guys need to take these sets down tonight because I can get Todd down here with the Makita." Mrs. Palin's whole camp was helpful. Her hairstylist made adjustments to my wig to make it look even more like the governor's hair. Her makeup artist identified the lip color that we've been trying to figure out for 4 weeks. It was just lip liner under chapstick. And then it was 11:30. Seth wrote an admirable sneaker upper. Some solid jokes at the top, and Alec was funny with her backstage. There was the requisite amount of sweaty, feigned surprise. Governor Palin and I crossed paths for just an instant, and when she took center stage, she was greeted with a long round of applause. I'd like to think my suggestion of starting her backstage paid off, but more likely, I had underestimated what a giant media star Sarah Palin was. Even the New Yorkiest audience was giddy to see her in person. After the show, I felt compelled to find Mrs. Palin in her dressing room and say goodbye. "Good job. You should come back and host sometime," I said. She certainly could handle it. And then, "Now, you're going to tell everyone you had a good time in New York City, right? And that everyone was really nice to you?" Mrs. Palin smiled and nodded. "Yep, nobody was scary or anything." I couldn't believe the condescension that was coming out of my mouth. I was talking to this woman like I was reminding a child to say please. I guess I was just hoping that wherever the campaign took her the next day, she would include New York City as one of the pro-America parts of her country. In my opinion, the most meaningful moment for women in the 2008 campaign was not Governor Palin's convention speech or Hillary Clinton conceding her 1,896 delegates. The moment most emblematic of how things have changed for women in America was 9 months pregnant Amy Poehler rapping as Sarah Palin and tearing the roof off the place. Watching Amy rap made me so happy that she had found a way to make real comedy out of a sneaker upper. The virtuosity and joyfulness of her performance made me feel like it was time for me to hand this job back to the professionals. I felt like that character in Flowers for Algernon, not Charlie, the lady teacher from the college who realizes, "I've got to stop dry humping this mentally challenged guy." The rating was 10.7, 14 million people. One more weird time and that's it? The week before the election, John McCain wanted to come on the show. I had met Senator McCain when he hosted SNL in 2002, and we all liked him very much. He was not one of the unnamed D-bags. He gave my husband and me a tour of the Senate before we posed together for a Get Out the Vote cover of Life magazine that you can find in your PDF. The magazine went under immediately after that cover, by the way. Did it seem insane that a presidential candidate would want to appear in a sketch parodying his running mate just days before the election? Uh-huh, yes. Sure, but what didn't seem insane then? A Kenyan communist Muslim was about to be elected president. Seth wrote a sketch about McCain Palin buying time on QVC as a last-ditch effort to reach voters. For the last time in the SNL makeup room, Jane, the makeup artist, overdrew my lips to make my mouth look wider. Louie glued my ears down. My ears stick out and Sarah's don't. And Betty popped on my long brown wig. I went to Senator McCain's dressing room to read through the cue cards with him, and he started laughing uncontrollably when he saw me. It's just weird, he said. And that was it. We had gone through the entire life cycle of an SNL character, from first-time jitters to sneaker-upper to this again, in 6 weeks. One of the best parts of all this is that my daughter may actually have childhood memories of going to SNL. I left so soon after she was born, I didn't think she would know that place or those people, but now she will, which means a lot to me because that was my home for a long time. One of the worst parts of all this was that I learned what it felt like to be a lightning rod. I got some hate mail, and there are definitely people out there who will dislike me for the rest of my life because of what I did to Sarah Palin. On an intellectual level, this doesn't bother me at all. On a human level, I would prefer to be liked. There was an assumption that I was personally attacking Sarah Palin by impersonating her on TV. No one ever said it was mean when Chevy Chase played Gerald Ford falling down the stairs all the time. No one ever accused Dana Carvey or Daryl Hammond or Dan Aykroyd of going too far in their political impressions. You see what I'm getting at here. I am not mean, and Mrs. Palin is not fragile. To imply otherwise is a disservice to us both. It wasn't the last time, apparently. Also, I am available for parties and corporate events. A few months after our friendly chat about kids and my condescending remarks about New York, Mrs. Palin told conservative filmmaker John Ziegler that Katie Couric and I had exploited and profited by her family. But I know better than to respond to attacks in the media. Although, if I were to respond, I would probably just say, nice reality show. Or maybe I'd point out that when those sketches were watched 58 million times on the internet around the world, I was paid nothing because actors don't get any money for internet reuse. Get ready for an actor strike in 2012, y'all. But I'd probably just know better than to respond. Some may argue that exploiting Governor Palin and her family helped bring attention to my low-rated TV show. I am proud to say that you are wrong. My TV show still enjoys very low ratings. In fact, I think the Palin stuff may have hurt the TV show. Let's face it, between Alec Baldwin and me, there is a certain 50% of the population who think we are pinko commie monsters. There's a drunk midget in my house. Ah, oh, babies. They're more than just adorable little creatures on whom you can blame your farts. Like most people who have had one baby, I am an expert on everything and will tell you, unsolicited, how to raise your kid. Breastfeeding versus formula. Invented in the mid-1800s as a last-ditch option for orphans and underweight babies, packaged infant formula has since been perfected to be a complete and reliable source of stress and shame for mothers. Anyone who reads a pregnancy book knows that breast milk provides nutrition, immunities, and invaluable bonding time. The breast is best. Unless you need to get back on your psych meds or something, in which case, give your baby Crystal Light on the go, or whatever it takes for you to not go crazy. But if you're healthy, you really should nurse. You owe it to your baby to breastfeed. When I was pregnant, remember, I was pregnant once, and I'm on TV. Those two things combined make me an expert. I was confused as to why all the literature about breastfeeding was surrounded by ads for formula. The free magazines in my doctor's office all said the same thing in their articles. Breastfeeding is best for your baby. But overwhelming those articles were pages of heartwarming, full-color ads saying things like, your baby deserves the best. Infamilk, now with more Crifthicodinium. Doctors say, breastfeed, or if you're an adoptive mother, try Simamil. 10 out of 100,000. Doctors say Infante. Probably doesn't cause blindness. No other formula gives your baby a better start in life, except the stuff that comes out of you for free. Should I breastfeed or not? I asked my mother for advice. Don't even try it, she said. This is a generational difference. This is the same woman who told me to request twilight sleep during delivery. Twilight sleep is the memory-erasing pain medication that doctors gave women in the 1950s whenever they had to either take a baby out or put a body snatcher in. I could never have chosen twilight sleep because I wanted to be present for my birth experience, and also it is no longer offered. My mom is a depression baby. As a member of Generation X, I was more informed, more empowered, and I knew that when it came to breastfeeding, I had an obligation to my baby to pretend to try. I chose to breastfeed, and it was an amazing time in my life. It really changed me as a woman, and it's the most gratifying thing I have ever done, except for several very satisfying work-related things. There are a lot of different opinions as to how long one should breastfeed. The World Health Organization says 6 months. The American Association of Pediatrics says 1 year is ideal. Mothering Magazine suggests that you nurse the child until just before his rehearsal dinner. I say you must find what works for you. For my little angel and me, the magic number was about 72 hours. We began our breastfeeding journey in the hospital under the tutelage of an encouraging Irish night nurse named Mary. We tried the football hold, the cross cradle hold, and one I like to call the Brett Michaels, where you kind of lie over the baby and stick your breast in its mouth to wake it up. We didn't succeed, so that first night, the other nurses gave my little one some formula without asking. I tried to be appalled, but I was pretty tired. Once we got home, I tried again. I abandoned all vanity, as one must, and parked it shirtless on the couch. Here we experienced another generational difference. Gen X wanted to succeed at this so she could tell people she did it, And little Gen Z wanted me to hand over that goddamn formula, and she was willing to scream until she got it. One of my 500 nicknames for my daughter is Midge, which is short for midget because she was a very small baby. She was born a week early and a little underweight at 5 pounds, 7 ounces. My obstetrician suggested the next day at her bedside visit that perhaps I hadn't rested enough during my pregnancy and that was why she was so small. What a cunt, I thought to myself, in what was either a flash of postpartum hormones or an accurate assessment of my doctor's personality. So we started supplementing Midge regularly with formula. She was small, and I didn't want her to get any smaller while I mastered the ancient art of breastfeeding to prove how incredible and impressive I am. Of course, I still provided her breast milk. You must provide them with breast milk. You owe it to your baby to get them that breast milk. Here's how it works. If you choose not to love your baby enough to breastfeed, you can pump your milk using a breast pump. This may be easier for the modern mom because it is an expensive appliance, and we're more comfortable with those than with babies. Set up a pumping ritual for yourself that is relaxing and consistent. I chose to pump every 2 hours while watching episodes of the HBO series Entourage on demand. Over the whir of the milking machine, I could almost hear my baby being lovingly cared for in the other room while Turtle yelled across an SUV, "Yo, E, you ever fuck a girl while she has her period?" I was able to do this for almost 7 weeks before running out of Entourage episodes and sinking into a deep depression. Shortly thereafter, we made the switch to an all-formula diet. If you've ever opened a can of infant formula, then you know it smells like someone soaked old vitamins in a bucket of wet leaves and then dried them in a hot car. Also, formula is like $40 a can. They keep it locked up behind the counter with the batteries and meth ingredients. That's how bad people want this stuff. However, the baby was thriving. I was no longer feeling trapped, spending 30 out of every 90 minutes attached to a Williams-Sonoma tit juicer. But I still had an overwhelming feeling of disappointment. I had failed at something that was supposed to be natural. I was defensive and grouchy whenever the topic came up. At a party with a friend who was successfully nursing her little boy, I watched her husband produce a bottle of pumped breast milk that was the size of a big gulp. It was more milk than I had produced in my whole 7 weeks. I blame Entourage. As my friend's husband fed the baby, he said offhandedly, "Oh, this stuff is liquid gold. You know what actually makes them smarter? Let's set a date," I screamed. "IQ test 5 years from today. My formula baby will crush your baby." Thankfully, my mouth was so full of cake, they couldn't understand me. Once I let go of my guilt, which took a while, the only remaining obstacle was the teat Nazis. These are the women who not only brag endlessly about how much their 5-year-old still loves breast milk, but they also grill you about your choices. You can recognize the teat Nazis by their hand-carved daggers. "Are you breastfeeding? Isn't it amazing? I really think it's how I lost the weight so easily. Did you have a vaginal birth? I went natural and I didn't even tear. Are you back at work already? Do you feel weird about going back to work? I just love my baby so much I can't imagine going back to work yet. You're not nursing? She's only 15 months. You should try again." Now let me be clear. Millions of women around the world nurse their children beautifully for years without giving anybody a hard time about it. Teat Nazis are a solely Western upper-middle-class phenomenon occurring when highly ambitious women experience deprivation from outside modes of achievement. Their highest infestation pockets are in Brooklyn and Hollywood. If you are confronted by a teat Nazi, you have two options. One, when they ask you if you're breastfeeding, you can smile and say, "Yes, it's amazing. You owe it to your baby to lie." Or you can go for the kill. The only people who can shame the teat Nazis are the adoptive mommies. If you have a friend who has an adopted child, especially one from another country, bring him or her around, because they make the teat Nazis' brains short circuit. "How can I feel superior? You, bigger sacrifice, can't judge." And then their big old dinner plate nipples pop off as they crumple to the ground and disappear. Lesson learned? When people say you really, really must do something, it means you don't really have to. No one ever says, "You really, really must deliver the baby during labor." When it's true, it doesn't need to be said. Me time. Any expert will tell you the best thing a mom can do to be a better mom is to carve out a little time for herself. Here are some great me time activities you can do. Go to the bathroom a lot. Offer to empty the dishwasher. Take 90-minute showers. If you only shower every 3 or 4 days, it'll be easier to get away with this. Say you're going to look for the diaper cream and then go into your child's room and just stand there until your spouse comes in and curtly says, "What are you doing?" Stand over the sink and eat the rest of your child's dinner while he or she pulls at your pant leg asking for it back. Try to establish that you're the only one in your family allowed to go to the post office. Sleep when your baby sleeps. Everyone knows this classic tip, but I say why stop there? Scream when your baby screams. Take Benadryl when your baby takes Benadryl. Walk around pantless when your baby walks around pantless. Poop in the bathtub when they poop in the bathtub. Read. When your baby is finally down for the night, pick up a juicy book like Eat, Pray, Love or Pride and Prejudice, or my personal favorite, Understanding Sleep Disorders, Narcolepsy and Apnea, a Clinical Study. Taking some time to read each night really taught me how to feign narcolepsy when my husband asked me what my plan was for taking down the Christmas tree. Just implementing 4 or 5 of these little techniques will prove restorative and give you the energy you need to not drink until nighttime. A Celebrity's Guide to Celebrating the Birth of Jesus. Goldie and Kurt like to soak in the crystal blue waters of St. Bart's. Melanie and Antonio prefer the festive chill of Aspen. Tina and Jeff are absolutely mad for Route 80 West between Philadelphia and Youngstown. We never miss it. Lying on a beach feels a little first thought to me. I prefer the retro chic of spending Christmas just like Joseph and Mary did, traveling arduously back to the place of your birth to be counted, with no guarantee of a bed when you get there. You may end up sleeping on an old wicker couch with a dog licking your face while an Ab Rocket infomercial plays in the background. It's a modern-day manger. Our annual pilgrimage from one set of in-laws to the other happens every December 26th, or as they call it in Canada, Boring Day. We always plan to leave around 7 in the morning, and like clockwork, we are out the door by 10. After gassing up, de-icing, and turning around for an unanticipated bowel movement, we glide onto glorious 80 West by 10:30. Sure, there are those trendy types who prefer 76/70 because it's more scenic and they have a McDonald's, but I think 80 West has a certain souci de prime. My husband drives the whole 7 hours because I don't currently have a driver's license. It's just one of the many ways in which I am developmentally stunted. I don't drive, I can't cook meat correctly, and I have no affinity for animals. I don't hate animals, and I would never hurt an animal. I just don't actively care about them. When a coworker shows me cute pictures of her dog, I struggle to respond correctly, like an autistic person who has been taught to recognize human emotions from flashcards. In short, I am the worst. There are plenty of positives to being married to me. I just can't think of any of them right now, and I'm sure my husband can't think of any of them either when he's driving wideways across Pennsylvania. Still, there's something hypnotic and relaxing about cruising through the Alleghenies, frantically searching for a radio signal. If traffic is moving well, you won't ever find a station that lasts for an entire song. So you nestle in between your baking hot dashboard and the freezing cold door and enjoy the radio static with occasional fragments of a shouted religious broadcast.
Friends, are you living in such a way that there is a crown in heaven waiting for you? A man must die of self.
When you feel about to die of self, pull over and enjoy one of the local eateries. I recommend the Roy Rogers at exit 4B or the Roy Rogers at exit 78. If you're a diehard foodie, hop off the road in Dubois and enjoy a Subway sandwich at a place that is 80% gas station.
Youngstown!
My husband always yells as we pass the sign. He yells it in a way that you can actually hear the letters getting bigger at the end like an old-timey postcard. It never fails to startle me and make me laugh. Half the time, it wakes me up. Yes, I fall asleep while he's driving. Did I mention that I am the worst? In the last hour, highway turns to snowy country roads, and the GPS system shuts down because you're in a part of the world that Toyota doesn't recognize, and the feeling is mutual. We always pull up carefully, making sure not to run over any outdoor cats. One of the best-kept secrets of country life is that people accidentally crush their own pets a lot. The house is cozy warm from the wood-burning heater. There are hugs and kisses and pies and soup and ham and biscuits and a continuous flow of Maxwell House coffee with non-dairy creamer. We city folk can pretend that we prefer the rot gut from StarCorp with skim milk and Splenda, but who are we kidding? Maxwell House coffee with French vanilla corn syrup cannot be beat. If there's one thing my husband's hometown has that St. Bart's does not, it's the water. Legally potable doesn't quite capture it. Straight from the tap, it smells like... how can I describe it? If you boiled 10,000 eggs in a prostitute's bathwater. It turns your jewelry green, but it leaves your hair soft and manageable, so while I couldn't find it in St. Bart's,